From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. Priorities change when situations become desperate. Today we'll hear why one Georgia school system has changed its standards to try and get more teachers into classrooms. And we'll talk about the work that's being done in the wake of disaster in Ecuador.
Ecuador's president, Rafael Correa, says the priority now is to clear the dead bodies.
There are critical hours during which there is hope of life. But on the other hand, there are dead bodies in the rubble beginning to decompose. So we must deal with those bodies and worry more about that than the remote possibility that someone is still alive.
We'll talk with a pair of global relief workers on the ground there this hour. First, though, we heard from musician Charles Connor yesterday. He's played in backing bands for megastars like Little Richard and James Brown, Sam Cooke and Jackie Wilson.
Richard, now, before we record, what happened was the wop bop loo bop the bop bam boo. Richard got that address from my drums. Bop da 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 boom. One up on the bass drum. Bop da 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 bop da 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 boom.
And we wondered if you'd ever had a memorable run-in with a celebrity. Well, here are your first thoughts.
Hi, I'm Elaine from Atlanta, and I have a wonderful brush with celebrity story. Back in 91, I lived in New York, and I worked at Serendipity 3. And one day, Jackie O and her granddaughter came in for lunch. And I waited on them, and they were so sweet, and it was wonderful. But I was so excited that I had to go to the payphone. Yes, we had payphones back then. And call my grandma to let her know. And it was just a really cool moment and something I've never forgotten.
We always love to hear what you think, and we especially love to hear your story. So call us and tell us your stories at 404-500-9457. That's what Elaine did. We're also on the Twitter at OSD Talker. You can post on Facebook, and we might feature your comments on the show. A 7.8 magnitude earthquake left hundreds dead and thousands homeless in Ecuador. Global relief organizations were on the ground there. One of them is Georgia-based MAP International. MAP president and CEO Steve Sterling joins me now. Good morning, Steve.
Good morning, Celeste. Thank you for inviting us to be on your show.
It's a pleasure to have you. Also with us from Bolivia is Stella Losado. She's a community health specialist for MAP International, and she's working with relief workers in Ecuador. Thanks for being with us, Stella.
Thank you. Good morning to everybody.
Stella, I understand you're actually from Ecuador. Can you tell us how severe is the damage?
I think we are all astonished with how severe is the situation and how traumatic for the whole country this crisis we are facing right now. It seems like every day is becoming more evident the consequences of this disaster. It's so large that it's not easy to face in one war. It's many areas that has been devastating the whole country. The impact is very large, yes, in the life of people, families, communities, and the whole country.
Steve, MAP provides medical assistance, correct? What does that mean?
We provide in situations like either man-made or natural disasters, medicines that are vital to survival, medicines like antibiotics, wound care, clean in terms of having, you know, one of the biggest problems is after an earthquake, as an example, is that then the water gets contaminated. And then we provide antibiotics and ORS, oral rehydration solution, so they can stay healthy and live. You know, and a simple cut, as an example, from an earthquake, if you're not treated, it can turn into infection. And that's really what we're trying to make sure we get some life-saving medicines into Ecuador, and this is happening right now.
Meaning that if I get a cut right now in my house and I put Neosporin on it and a Band-Aid, it's nothing. But if I do that in a place that's been torn by earthquake, it could get infected and kill me.
Absolutely. And then also the contaminated water, the infrastructure has been devastated, and so people will get sick through drinking dirty water, and we all get really sick from various things. And then so our antibiotics and oral rehydration solutions, and we also provide, you know, gauzes and gloves and all the support the medical community to be able to provide life-saving support to their people who've been affected by the earthquake.
Stella, what's the biggest need there? Is it clean water?
Actually, it has become a very high priority. People are desperate to have drinking water at this moment. Some stories tell about people that are even paying $5 for a bottle of water, and whatever the donation of water comes to the plate disappears very rapidly. Yes, water is becoming a very important. But they also are in big need of antibiotics. A lot of infections are coming now.
Are there a lot, Stella, are there a lot of aid workers there working? Are you among a community of relief workers?
There's a lot of support from different health staff from other places that have not been affected by this earthquake, and volunteers that are providing support, yes. But still, there is a need for more specialized people like surgeons and people that work with those wounded patients.
Steve,
people that speak physicians or specialized physicians who speak Spanish.
Oh, yeah, I can imagine. And Steve, I wonder, you know, we've seen in the wake of, it seems like only certain natural disasters, the Haiti earthquake, for example, or the tsunami, that the global outpouring of charity and aid and money and supplies is overwhelming. Have we seen that with this earthquake in Ecuador?
We have not. No, not. I want to thank Georgia Public Radio for covering this because you were doing a wonderful job. No, it has not. Because of the election that was going on, Prince's death, and other media and news that's out there, we have not gotten much coverage on the Ecuador earthquake. And in fact, I've seen pictures from our staff and volunteers, and it's really horrific pictures. And I don't think the media has covered it to the extent it needs to be covered, because the need is great out there, and we need to come to the aid of our folks living south of the border in the country of Ecuador. So we need the help to get these people help right away, because each day is really life-threatening if we don't address these issues right away.
How did MAP come to be based out of Atlanta, Steve?
Well, this is a long story, but you know, MAP, we are in two locations, actually, Atlanta and also Brunswick, Georgia. We have our distribution center because we ship our containers out of Savannah and in Jacksonville. But we have an office in Atlanta as well because we believe that's where the global health community resides. So we've been in Atlanta for over 15 years, and we work closely with other nonprofits. So we could do this work together, and so we could help people around the world that are hurting.
So I understand the first shipment, the MAP shipment at least, to Ecuador will leave today.
That's correct.
And what's in that shipment?
You know, first, just to show you, because we have staff on the ground, that they were able to work with the Ministry of Health. We were able to get this done pretty quickly, but in the first shipment, we have basic medical supplies like antibiotics, analgesics, wound care products, and other products that will first, when you have a disaster, that you need those kind of products to be able to just help people who are hurting, but also antibiotics that will either topical or oral to keep diseases from literally ending a person's life.
Stella, you know, I'm sure that when your needs are clean water and medication, that you're not thinking too much about headlines. But I wonder if people in Ecuador feel that they're not getting the attention and charity and relief that they need or want. Do they feel that their disaster is not getting a global eyes?
Yes, I think that's a very strong sense that they are not being supported enough, and there's a lot of communities that are not being reached at this moment. Still, we are talking about 17,000 population wounded, and we have, like, at this point, 48 still that are disappeared, 30,000 people displaced.
So 30,000, you said?
30,000 displaced people, and 17,600 wounded people in need. So it's a lot of need. We need the coordinates to support us with more of this need to protect these people, wounded people, so kind of medicines and supplies to provide support.
Are the hospitals overwhelmed at this point? I mean, with 17,000 people who've been injured, some of them very seriously, I can't imagine they have the kind of capacity, Stella.
Yes, that's right. That's a big problem that hospitals, health centers, and health professionals have not been able to cover all this huge need that we have.
So, Steve, you know, this is not the kind of earthquake that can, where the recovery will be quick. Do you have any idea how long the need will continue in Ecuador?
A year or more, because when you devastate the infrastructure, and like you were mentioning about the hospitals and clinics and that having, many of them were physically also damaged, but we have to then replenish the stock of medicines and supplies that have been depleted. So this will be a long-term recovery. And unfortunately, the media doesn't cover much after the initial shock. And so this will be ongoing. And we have staff on the ground in Ecuador to provide some support. And we work with partners to provide the medical and medicines. We're grateful for support from our listeners, your listeners, and to help provide medicines that we have in stock in Georgia, in Brunswick, Georgia. We need to then get them onto containers. Initially, we have the initial stock going over there by air, but then after that, we'll be putting them on containers and then shipping 20, 40-foot containers to
on
Ecuador.
Boats.
On boats, yes. We could get much more product on boats, on freight liners.
Is it just, Steve, do you think it's just the election and Prince's death, for example, that have kept Ecuador's tragedy out of the headlines?
You know, I think also sometimes people react because there's so many people were killed, and the initial numbers were in maybe 100, 200, and then not into thousands, and I think that that sometimes impacts people. But literally, there's now, as Stella is saying, you have 17,000 people needing help right away because they've been hurt. And if you don't help those people relatively soon, those people can get infection in other ways, and they could also perish. So it's now you're trying to save those 17,000 plus other people who have been displaced that don't have access to water. So we're also supplying water filters as an example so they can have clean water so they won't get some kind of rotavirus diarrhea, and then you could die from the diarrhea as well.
So it's kind of a creeping disaster. It's unfolding over time.
It is. It really is. And I think people need to respond as quick as possible because we can still save these lives if we can very quickly. If not, if you wait too long, they will be too weak to recover.
That is Steve Sterling. He's the president and CEO of Georgia-based MAP International. That's a relief organization that is, as you heard, providing assistance to Ecuador after the earthquake. We also heard from Stella Losado. She's MAP Community Health Specialist. Stella and Steve, thank you both so much.
You're very welcome. I just really thank you for what you're doing and ask our listeners to go to map.org and please help us to ship these medicines out to people who need them. And thank you very much.
And thank you, Stella.
Thank you so much.
This is On Second Thought.
You, who are on the road, must have a code that you can live by, and so become yourself, because the past is just a goodbye.
We've heard a lot about what is driving people away from the profession of teaching. A lot of testing, low pay, limited resources. Many new teachers abandon their careers within the first 5 years. The Savannah Chatham schools have turned to a little-known certificate program that's designed to help replenish that pool of teachers. It gives qualified people with bachelor degrees the opportunity to become teachers, even if they've never studied education. That program gives applicants temporary teaching certificates while they work towards permanent qualifications. Stephen Ruth is one of those certified teachers. He's a maker teacher at the STEM Academy in Savannah, which we will explain in just a moment. And he joins us now. Hi, Stephen.
Hello.
And also with us is Heather Bilton. She's the Talent Acquisition Coordinator for the Savannah Chatham School System. Hi, Heather.
Good morning.
Stephen, for those who don't know what a maker is, can you explain?
Sure. I basically take some of the abstract concepts that students are learning in their other classes and help give them a physical way to present those. So we make things, basically.
Like, can you give me an example of some things you've made?
Sure, absolutely. My eighth graders right now, because in physical science they've looked at buoyancy and displacement, we're actually building boats.
And what is your degree in?
I have a liberal studies degree with a minor in physical science.
And why did you want to teach? Your wife is a teacher of many years, is she not? So what brought you in?
Correct. She's been teaching for about 20 years, so I've been around the career for a long time. And before I became a teacher, I was actually a coach. And one big aspect of coaching I like is the teaching aspect and being able to see students, or actually athletes at that time, go from a spot at the beginning and develop over time, and you should be able to show the growth in them.
Now, Heather, this program of bringing in people who do not have teaching degrees or certificates is not new. So why the new attention on it?
You're correct. It's not new. But in Savannah Chatham, we've been really focusing on alternative pathways for about the last 10 years because it brings in people with really great real-life authentic experiences to share in the classroom. We have a teacher shortage, as you mentioned, and the crux of that is because students aren't going into teacher preparation programs. So Savannah Chatham needs about 400 teachers this year, which is the normal number for a district our size. But we don't have those students graduating out of teacher preparation programs. So we have to think differently, think out of the box. But one of the things that we found is our alternative pathways teachers are just as successful as teachers trained through teacher preparation. Our current teacher of the year, Ernie Lee, is an attorney turned U.S. history teacher.
By what, when you say they're just as successful, what are you using to measure?
Impact on student achievement.
Is that test scores?
Yeah, test scores, exactly.
So one of the things I wanted to ask you about, Stephen, is because we've talked to a lot of teachers. The teacher shortage is driven by people who are very unhappy with the profession. They've complained about some of the things I mentioned earlier, a lot of testing, very low pay, limited resources, a difficulty to rise in either pay or position. And that must be things that you hear about from your wife all the time, are they not?
Sure, absolutely. It's stuff we live with every day. But for me, it goes beyond all that. And I mean, we're in a crisis in education right now. And I think it's more important than ever to find good teachers and to stay in the classroom and kind of push through all these things because it's all about the next generation.
So let's hear from another person who's part of this program. Joyce Chow is a math teacher at Islands High School. She here is explaining why she decided to do it.
You find yourself useful, you're happy. You're not just, you know, like, of course you get paid, but it's not as, that is not important. It's more important is that you find yourself meaningful to this world. And the student makes you feel like, wow, I can really help them, you know? And you are really doing something positive in their life. You're changing someone.
Now, that kind of purpose and mission and optimism, Heather, is something that we hear from new teachers all the time, and yet the retention rate is not good among teachers. Many of them don't make it past the 5 years, as I mentioned. What about retention of the teachers in the Alternative Pathways program?
Well, most of the teachers that come through Alternative Pathways tend to be a little bit older. They're coming in through a second career. We've just hired a man who is getting ready to retire as a colonel from the Air Force, and he's going to teach mathematics. They tend to, they've had their first career, they've been very successful, and now they want to give back. They have that passion, they have those real life experiences so they can bring authentic stuff to the classroom, and they tend to stay. They tend to stay. They've already done their first career, and they're ready to settle down. They want a little bit more out of a career.
Now, I want to read you a couple tweets here. I asked on Twitter, is this a good idea? And one person said, Bobby Seifter, I hope I'm pronouncing that right, as a former TFA, that's Teach for America, core member, teacher with no ed degree, I'm inclined to say no to people without education degrees becoming teachers. And then Sam Burnham tweets, there's a misconception that transitioning to an education job is easy and you get the summer off. We need educators who are dedicated to the kids and to education. It's no place to hide until retirement. Stephen, do you have a response to that comment?
Sure. I know lots of teachers that have come to teaching through Alternative Pathways, and I think they're some of the best and hardest working teachers I know. And I think in a lot of ways, there's certain things that an education background kind of handcuffs you in. You feel like there's certain ways to deal with everything in the classroom, where if you've come from another background where you've been in the corporate world maybe or done management, you maybe already have some of those skills and can approach that in a different way in the classroom.
How long do you get, Heather, to earn your teaching certificate?
The state of Georgia allows you to have 3 years. So during the course of those 3 years, you're in a program to convert your certificate, your IN4 certificate, to a professional certificate. The other thing in Savannah is that we offer a lot of induction support. So we tell people from the very beginning, this is a hard job. It is a hard job. We don't sugarcoat it with the a place to hide before retirement. We certainly don't believe that at all. We want to make sure that they understand that teaching is a challenging but extremely rewarding career.
And, you know, I wonder how much of a solution do you think this is? You know, if there's different methods of getting teachers into classroom in terms of going to schools, trying to get more people graduation with an ed degree, and this is one of those options. How effective do you think it is?
Well, we started our first sessions, Ernie Lee and I, the Georgia Teacher of the Year, here in Savannah, quarterly sessions. We've had over 1,000 people come out face-to-face who have had interest, and probably another 1,000 that have sent emails or phone calls that are very interested. A lot of people went into college. They didn't know what they wanted to do. They got into a field, and they thought, man, I always wanted to be a teacher. So when they've heard about that you don't have to go back for another 4-year degree, they're very interested in what they can bring to the classroom. We probably have over 150 right now on IN4 certificates, and they really are helping us fill business teaching areas, secondary mathematics, science, but they come from industry where they have a strong content knowledge and they can share that in the classroom.
We would love to hear from those of you listening. If you're a college grad, would you try teaching? Is there a specific subject that you think you'd be good at teaching? You can tweet us at OST Talk or join the conversation on Facebook. My guests are teacher Stephen Ruth and Heather Bilton of the Savannah School System. We're talking about a program that allows those who have bachelor degrees to enter the field of teaching while they earn their teaching certificate. Heather, you mentioned business. Are there specific subject matters that somebody in the alternative pathways is going to be more successful at teaching?
I don't know about more successful, but we certainly have higher needs in secondary mathematics, science, Spanish, business, special ed classrooms. But we get people coming in on alternative pathways from really interesting backgrounds. Some famous artists have come in to teach our classes. So it really opens up opportunities for people with strong real-life experiences, authentic experience. I know I keep saying that, but that's what really makes that curriculum come alive to students. And that's one of the things that we have found our alternative pathways, as well as our traditionally prepared teachers, can offer in the classroom.
Stephen, did your wife take the traditional pathway? Did she get an education degree before she became a teacher?
She did. She actually started with a political science degree and then went back and got her teaching education. But yes, she was very much traditional.
So what does she think about your theory that perhaps getting an education degree teaches you one basic method of dealing with issues and being out into the real world teaches you another?
I think she's okay with that. I know that she's been very successful in her classroom, and I feel like I've been successful in my classroom, so I think she can see both sides of that.
But do you think that you are both have a different style?
Absolutely. I think style is one thing that is individual to teacher, no matter what your background is.
No matter what of your training is?
Correct.
But you are finishing your teaching certificate?
I have a teaching certificate currently. I've been with Savannah Chatham for 6 years now, and so I went through the program, and it took me about a year and a half to get my clear and renewable certificate.
What things did you learn through the teaching certificate that helped you out? I assume that going through all that training did help you with strategies for the classroom. What were they?
Absolutely. There was mainly it's looking at classroom management and things like that. when you go through the program, you have a mentor that's with you, that's in the school that you're with, that you can get feedback from, and then you also have an outside mentor that comes and observes in the classroom and gives you feedback on things you're doing and where you can improve and, you know, some new strategies you might want to try.
So here's the thing, and I want to read you this tweet, Heather, that we just got from Jimmy Knoll, who says, I got my degree in finance. I'd be interested, but there's a low ceiling in salary. To what extent does the salaries of public school teachers interfere with your ability to recruit some of your top talent, people who worked at NASA, et cetera, et cetera?
Sure, yes. Money does become an issue, but we have been working, and especially in Savannah, our school board's been very supportive of raising salaries. You can actually do very well in the classroom compared to other fields. A starting teacher salary in Savannah Chatham, who has their professional certification, is $38,760, and that's with 0 years of experience. So that's not a bad starting salary.
And how far up does that? Is there an upper ceiling?
Oh, I think when you get about 25 years, if you had a doctorate degree, it may be maybe about 70,000.
Okay, so your starting salary is just under 38,000.
Well, 38,760.
Okay, so almost 39.
Correct.
Were you concerned, Stephen, about the money? I mean, because your wife is already living on a public teacher salary.
No, because for me, I knew that we don't have any children, and I knew that was going to be enough for us to be okay and take care of the things we need to do and be able to do what we want to do. And then there's opportunities outside of school, too, as far as other income and, you know, working other jobs during the summer and things like that. It really wasn't something that entered my mind.
And yet you've now been doing it for 6 years. I wonder what you think of complaints of teachers, because they talk about not only is there a low salary, and we've heard on this program teachers telling us they have to keep part-time jobs in order to make ends meet, but also they end up buying a lot of the resources that they need for this classroom. Has that been your experience?
Sure. Especially teaching the classroom that I teach, it requires a lot of materials. So I've bought things, and you have to be creative with ways that you can come up with money for your classroom. There's grants you can write. There's a great program called Donors Choose that helps teachers get things in the classroom that they need. So it's just, I think it's more about being creative than actually trying to pull money out of your pocket.
So Heather, how far does your recruiting go? Do people come to you mostly, or do you actually get out there and try to recruit people to do this?
Both. When we had our last session in March, we had a lot of media attention, and we had people drive from Jacksonville, from Virginia Beach, that were just interested in knowing more about how to become a teacher. So we do a lot of recruitment in a variety of ways. We certainly support our teacher preparation programs. We're here in Savannah by Armstrong State and Georgia Southern, and we host all of their student teachers, we host many of their student teachers. And we want to continue to help them grow their teacher prep programs, but we know that we have to look at alternative ways to get teachers in the classroom. We recruit all over the United States. We certainly tap into visitors coming to Savannah. We just ask them to go on teachsavannah.com and find out more about teaching in Savannah.
Is there a likely suspect? I mean, is there a particular type of person that you think would be most likely to do this? Because one thing, you know, we just got another tweet from Jimmy Knoll, who is pointing out something which would be an issue for me. He says many of us have a large amount of student debt that makes that transition almost impossible. I imagine that's true for a lot of people, especially here in Georgia, where we have the highest percentage of student debt in the country. Heather?
Okay. We do have loan forgiveness, not loan forgiveness through the school system or the state, but there's federal loan forgiveness programs for people who teach in high-need schools. Many of our schools qualify to enable loan forgiveness. But certainly there's all those barriers to getting in the classroom, and we acknowledge those barriers and keep working. The typical person that comes in often thought about teaching for a long time, and they just didn't know how to get into teaching. They didn't want to have to stop and accumulate more student loans and go back to a regular teacher preparation program. So this enables them, while they have that already bachelor's or a higher degree, to get into the classroom, to start making money to build their experience for teacher retirement. So they get all of those things while they're completing and doing what a lot of times they always wanted to do.
That is Heather Bilton. She is the Talent Acquisition Coordinator for the Savannah-Chatham School System, and Stephen Ruth is a maker teacher at the STEM Academy there in Savannah. Stephen and Heather, really interesting. Thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Thanks.
We've talked today about some successes in the Alternative Pathways to Teaching program. Savannah's teacher, Stephen Ruth, is one example of that. Now let's take a sort of broader look at that program and that philosophy with Maureen Downey. She's an education reporter for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution and author of the paper's Get Schooled blog. Good to have you, Grand Maureen.
Good morning.
So let's talk about how common this kind of program is, an Alternative Pathways to Teaching. Is that seen all across the nation?
It's seen all across the nation, and probably the best data that we have on those programs comes out of a study in North Carolina of how its teachers were getting to the classroom, and about 15% of their teachers came through some kind of alternative pathway.
So what data do we have? We just heard from Heather Bilton of the Savannah program, at least, who says they're just as these teachers are just as successful as any other teachers. Can we back that up with research?
Well, the Savannah program, obviously, I listened to them describe it, is clearly a very tailored, detailed program, and it's bound to be successful with that level of attention. You know, I would say what we know so far about alternative track programs to the classroom, it's not as promising. In North Carolina, for example, found that those teachers were not as effective in the classroom, particularly in the high school level where content is critical. Those teachers were not as successful based on student performance as teachers coming out of Carolina teacher prep programs. The National Council on Teacher Quality does a big assessment of all the teacher prep programs and has expanded that to alternative programs. And they found, in fact, that those programs were doing a worse job getting teachers ready for the classroom than traditional programs in general. So I think at this point, and again, we don't have a lot of studies, so the University of North Carolina study and the National Council on Teacher Quality study are just two that we have.
So I want to read you a few tweets or just reactions from our listeners to this conversation. First, we have Carrie Howell, who says, I dreamed of being a math teacher once. Now I'm an auto tech. I love the concept of bringing real life experience to classrooms. But then we have others like Cass Mudd, who says, patchwork solutions to structural problems. As long as education remains low priority, U.S. remains dependent upon foreign talent. How credible is that particular complaint, that really this is a Band-Aid on what's a larger problem?
Well, you know, one thing we have to be clear on is that while we have a teacher shortage in Georgia and nationwide, it is not across every area. In fact, we are overproducing the elementary school teachers nationwide. The shortage now is the shortage that existed in 2000, and that is the math, science, and special education and language teachers. So that's where our shortage is. And in fact, when you see them bringing teachers in from abroad, they're often math and science at the high school level. So in fact, we do have that problem. And I do agree that that is a bigger problem. And frankly, alternative tracking to teachers will not solve that. What North Carolina found is that it's mythical that people who are high performers, that we all talk about this, the rocket scientist who becomes the math teacher, that was very uncommon. Folks in high-paying fields like that don't leave. What they found in North Carolina is the career switchers, the folks coming mid-career, were actually slightly younger than what people thought, late 20s, 30s, and it wasn't working out. They were the sort of frustrated fashion designers who were switching to education. So the alternative track does not seem to be a way to solve the math science problem, because as you alluded, an engineer making $125,000 or $200,000 a year who has wonderful working conditions, can duck out at 10 o'clock for a latte at Starbucks, is not going to necessarily make a transition to an under pressure, high poverty school. And those are the schools that have the toughest time, you know, filling those teacher slots, where they can't leave the classroom and there's lukewarm coffee if there's any coffee. So that's what we have to keep in mind. We have to be realistic about what the problem is.
And, you know, to that point, we got this other tweet from Chester Loy who says, how is teaching in Savannah schools rewarding when all you do is teach for the GMAS test? Way too much paperwork and not enough teaching. And to what extent are these teachers cowed and depressed by the exact same complaints we hear from teachers who have ed degrees? Aren't they also going to be dealing with low pay, lots and lots of testing, and very few resources?
You know, I think when the teacher, regardless of what kind of program you come from, but let's focus on the alternative track, those teachers, according to the research, are the least prepared for the management that comes with teaching. So I think, in fact, they're probably aware of the low pay. I mean, some facts they know going in about teaching. What they don't know is how difficult it is to manage a classroom, and they don't really know the level of support. Teach for America usually fares very well when alternative teacher programs are evaluated. And the one thing that is cited over and over again is the ongoing support that Teach for America gives its teachers at places in public schools in America. So that is something that I think that we should be mimicking. I mean, all these alternative track programs need to have ongoing support, because the teachers coming in who don't go through the teacher prep have the least sort of training in what, you know, the big word, pedagogy, but they just don't know how to manage classrooms. And, you know, yesterday I sat down with a French researcher who's over in Atlanta here studying American school reforms, and what's interesting is that she told me that in France the problem is content. They hire teachers who know content, so folks come in, but they don't know how to teach and manage. So they are trying now classes they used to think were sort of silly, the whole idea of management, that's becoming more important in France. So I think that we have to keep that in mind, too, that there's something to be said for teacher prep programs, the formal, traditional ones, that actually teach you teacher management. And then it is critical, no matter where the new teacher comes from, that there's lots of support in place in terms of the administration, in terms of mentoring, in terms of just sort of SWAT teams that can come in and help a teacher who really is struggling. And that's what we don't have. That's what we lack.
But here's the thing, Maureen, and you can hopefully clear this up for me, because I'm confused at how it's different bringing these people in who do not have ed degrees as opposed to just fixing the problems that are turning our teachers away. For example, we got this tweet from Carrie Howell who says, I'm carrying $30,000 in student debt. I ended up in a manual labor field. So, you know, as we mentioned, pay versus debt is a huge problem. That could probably be solved even for incoming teachers, right? Couldn't we solve the testing program even for teachers who have an ed degree?
You know, I think that your question, which is really the big question, which is how to make teaching a more attractive profession so that the kids who are at the very top of their class are the ones who are drawn to teaching. Once we get those teachers in the door, how do we keep them? So
yeah.
That's an hour-long discussion, but certainly money is a factor.
Yeah, 5 minutes, Maureen.
Right. Okay. Let me just say this then. Train them better. Keep them. Increase the training that they have before they go into the classroom. Let them work under a mentor for at least a full year. Once they're in the classroom, assign them a mentor, reward them accordingly, and improve teaching conditions, and make the accord respect to the profession. Now, that said, that is a process that involves multiple institutions in this country, starting with high schools, the colleges, the districts, the state, the federal government, and I don't want to cite Finland, you know, too much, because people hate to hear about Finland, but they improve their schools by improving teacher quality. So being a teacher, getting into teacher prep in Finland is tougher than getting into their med and law schools. And that, we are a long way from that. We still have a lot of kids who have subpar grade point averages in college going into teaching. Not all of them. There's many smart people in teaching, but teaching is still seen, education majors are still seen as less than compared to math or science or engineering or law or finance. And that we have to change, and that's a big challenge.
Okay, so if this is an hour-long conversation, when we only have 4 minutes left, is there any proof? Do we have evidence that what you learn when you're going through an education degree makes you better prepared? And by that, I mean we hear a lot about life experience. People who are older coming back, having worked in an actual garage, maybe if they're teaching shop in high school. People who've been working in a computer corporation, maybe if they're going to teach technology. Does that life experience make you a better teacher?
I would say that life experience gives you more experiences, but whether or not those experiences are relevant to the classroom, for example, the two things that you named, the garage and the computer company, you have a class of 33 kids. Half of them are below grade average. You know, some of them are living homeless shelters. Some of them have parents with drug or alcohol problems. Nothing that you told me there necessarily makes them able to teach those kids to sort of cope in that situation. I think teaching, and particularly in a high poverty school, is an incredibly stressful life. So I'm not sure those experiences, real life experiences, necessarily lend themselves to that. Nor do I think that, you know, necessarily a 4-year undergraduate degree does. But at least there, I think there are you're working with other educators. You're talking about these issues all the time, so you're not surprised by them. But again, I think once these teachers get to the classroom, whether they come the alternative route or they come through UGA or Georgia State, they have got to have a lot of supports in place and to keep them there. I mean, we're losing teachers, but what's interesting is, of course, that the tougher schools lose teachers more. I mean, so we have to recognize the fact that, you know, these classroom conditions play a role. I mean, there are teachers, some of the folks you described could easily go probably into high-achieving schools and do fine because there are minimal problems. The kids bring less baggage. Those same people may not fare well in a tough school where the poverty follows the kids. So the low-income schools, 21% of teachers leave their schools each year nationwide compared to 14% in low-poverty schools.
Wow.
So that's the difference.
In the minute and a half that we have, or minute that we have left, Maureen, why then does this myth persist where you hear people saying, well, I could teach better than these other teachers? Why do people think they can do that job better?
And it's interesting because you and I would not go to the dentist and say, I could fill that cavity, you know, better than my dentist, or, you know, I could actually do that brain surgery better. I think because everyone was a student and they saw teachers for 20 years of their lives if they went to college. So I think that people are familiar with what teachers do, and so they've sat in classrooms and thought, I can do this better. But of course, what none of us understand is that it's that the 33 kids or the 30 kids or the 25 kids, it is really a challenge to teach across different abilities.
Yeah.
I think that we think about ourselves as a student, but not think about all the classmates around us. In fact, and we didn't know the extent of those kids' problems. I mean, we have no idea what our teachers dealt with beyond us.
That's right. That's Maureen Downey. She's education reporter for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, writer of the Get Schooled blog. As always, thank you, Maureen.
Thank you.
This month marks the 400th anniversary of William Shakespeare's death. Over the weekend, students at Emory University in Atlanta paid tribute to the playwright with a 12-hour celebration of his work. GPB's Sean Powers got a front row at that, some of those performances, and he brings us this audio postcard.
Hello, everyone. We are Emory's only improv comedy troupe. Today, we're going to play two games for you. They're both going to be in the spirit of Shakespeare. None of us really knows anything about Shakespeare. How doth you do today? Oh, mine theater is in the gutter.
My name is Donald McManus, and I am an associate professor in the theater department.
I have no bread to feed to my family.
Hamlet's a real funny guy, and Iago's hilarious, and even King Lear has got a lot of punchlines. Comedy goes throughout Shakespeare.
Okay, so I was thinking...
Where beeth your Shakespearean speech?
I wast...
Better!
Thinking upon pondering the... Prithee... Romeo and... Much Ado.
My name is Alex Fellows, and I started acting this year at Emory with Dooley's Players, which is our student-run theater group, as well as Theater Emory, which is the professional theater on campus.
Now is the winter of our discontent, made glorious summer by the sun of York. And all the clouds that lowered upon our house.
Today at the Shakespeare Festival, we put on a few scenes from Richard III, which was the production we did past fall, and I played Richard III.
Our stern alarums changed
To merry meetings are dreadful marches to delightful measure.
I never really thought too much about doing Shakespeare. I'd never honestly been that interested in performing it, but I found that being able to do Shakespeare has really helped me become a much more confident actor. I'm still intimidated doing Shakespeare works now, even when I go and look into a new text to perform. I still get blown back about how smart the text is, and it's really interesting and amazing task to take on.
I'm Victoria, and everyone else here, we were all in the dual cast of As You Like It, and there were many songs in those shows, and we interpreted them and made our own melodies. Not so unkind as man's ingratitude, most friendship is feigning, most loving mere folly.
My name is Jan Akers. I'm on the faculty in the Department of Theater and Dance at Emory University. One of the things that we've been talking to our students about is that all of these stories are theirs as well.
Sounds from Emory University's celebration of William Shakespeare. Shakespeare died 400 years ago this month. Emory will soon offer up a close view of the first folio of Shakespeare. It was published in 1623. It's the first collected edition of Shakespeare's plays. It'll be on display at the university in November. And we'd like to hear from you. How good is your Shakespeare? The UK just hosted a Hamlet competition that even Prince Charles joined in for. Is there any Shakespeare line that you can actually recite by heart? Call us and recite. 404-500-9457. We're also on Twitter at OST Talk. For today, that's On Second Thought from GPB News. I'm Celeste Headley. Have a great day.